Okay, so let's get started. So in the midst of all the news that we've been hearing over the last several months regarding COVID-19, the coronavirus, and issues of racial injustice, embedded in those stories out of Israel, there's been a lot of discussion and conversation about Israel's plan to annex parts of the West Bank. And in fact, the reason why I scheduled this lecture for today, July the 1st, is because Israel, at least originally, had announced that today would be the day that it would annex a part of the West Bank. That did not take place. Unclear when or if it will occur. And what I thought would be of value to present this evening is to talk about the justification for Israel to annex the West Bank as parts of the West Bank, as well as some of the reasons why maybe Israel should not annex parts of the West Bank. And I want to look at it from a few different angles. Part of it hashkafic, part of it from a legal perspective, and not only a halachic legal perspective, but in terms of international law. I spent this past year teaching a course at the Farber Hebrew Day School entitled Israel and World Relations. It's a course that the school bought from an individual in Toronto. His name was Richard Bass, and I actually met with him. It's now the second or third time I've taught the course every 3 years, and he originally came into Detroit, and we sat down for a couple of days, and he taught the material to me. And so I want to share some of what he taught me, what I share with the students. And then towards the end, just look at it from a practical perspective. What are the practical benefits of doing it? What would be some of the dangers in annexing the parts of the West Bank? And part of the conversation will also be a moral conversation. Where, you know, sometimes things that we do may be technically permissible. It's not always something that we would recommend. It's not always a good thing to do. Even though it may be allowed, you know, you're allowed to eat as much ice cream as you want. It's not necessarily a good idea, though, to constantly eat ice cream, because it's not always be so healthy. It's not always so beneficial for your overall health. So you may have the choice, the ability to do it, but it's not always a good idea. And the question is this something that maybe Israel technically has the right to do, or maybe not? And even if it does, is it still a smart and a good decision? What I'm not going to do tonight, I'm not going to tell you one way or the other what my personal opinion is. I am certainly not an expert in this topic. Even more than that, I don't live in Israel, and I'm of the staunch opinion, I know others disagree with this, but since I do not live in Israel, I don't really feel that I have the right to tell Israelis what to do. I do know that Israel very much values, of course, Jews throughout the diaspora, and part of Israel's existence is not only for the Jews who live in Israel, but to protect, defend, and be supportive of Jews for, everywhere. At the same time, since I don't live there, I'm not a citizen, I don't vote, I don't send my children to the army, I don't really feel that I have the right to be telling Israelis what they should and should not do. So this is more just for curiosity, just to look at some of the issues, and to maybe for ourselves try to grapple with some of the things that Israelis are currently grappling when it comes to this particular issue. Okay, so let us begin. What I'm going to do is you should see on your screen this I'm going to be sharing with you this Google Sheets, this PowerPoint presentation. And again, the question is, does Israel have a legal right to annex territory in the West Bank? And after that question, should Israel annex that territory? Okay, so a point of departure will be a Rashi that I'm sure many of us are familiar with. We're familiar with this Rashi because it's the first Rashi in Chumash. It's probably something that we've learned, each of us, many times. And I always find, every time I learn this Rashi, I always find it fascinating, the fact that Rashi opens up Chumash with this comment because of its relevancy, obviously, to the issue at hand, but more so because of the primacy of the land of Israel for us, the Jewish people. The first comment out of Rashi's mouth is about Israel. And so Rashi tells us famously, Bereishis in the beginning, Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, L'hayat Sarach L'haskel Asat Torah El Adachos Hazel Lachem. Rashi asks a fundamental question as to what's the purpose of the Torah. Is the Torah a law book, or is the Torah a book about stories? And Rashi seems to assume that the Torah is a law book. And if the Torah is a law book, the Torah should begin with the first law. I need to hear stories about our ancestors. Tell me what I'm supposed to do as a Jew. And the first mitzvah given to the Jewish people is when the Jews were still in Egypt, they were told about the mitzvah of Rosh Chodesh. Why doesn't the Torah begin with that mitzvah? She mitzvah rishonish in stavu by Yisrael. Matam pasal bereishis. Why do I have to wait? You know, I read the Torah week in, week out in shul, so it takes a long time. I have to get all the way through bereishis, and then I have to do the parshios of Shemos and the Eira, and finally get to Bo and get to the first mitzvah. Why don't we just begin in parshios Bo, begin with the first mitzvah? So Rashi answers, Mishum koach masav higila amo. Rashi says, because God is the strength of God's deeds, the fact that God is the creator of the entire world, he's reminding, telling our his people, or he's telling us the fact that he's the creator. Why? So that we understand that why we have inherited their land. Meaning what? Because if the nations of the world will say to the Jewish people, can you believe this is actually possible? So we know, of course, this is very possible. If the nations of the world will say to the Jewish people, listen, Matem, you are thieves. You stole something. Shekvashtem artzo shiva goyim. You conquered the land, a land that's not yours. You conquered a land and took for yourself a land that belonged to the seven indigenous nations, city-states that were in the land of Israel. How can you be living in Israel? You took it from some other people. That's not right. You're thieves. So that's a pretty strong argument against us. So how are we going to respond? So Himor Mimlahem, we can respond, Kol Aret Shah Kadosh Baruch Hu. No, the entire earth is God's. Hu Bara Unasna Asher Yasha Beina. He created the entire earth. How do I know that? I have a Torah. I have a Torah that spends spends a lot of time, many chapters prior to even sharing the first mitzvah, telling us all about the fact that God was the creator of the world. And that world that God created, he gives to whoever he wants to give. He owns it. It says he can give it to whoever he wants. And in truth, we agree that originally God gave it to these seven nations. We don't dispute that. However, but at a certain point, he took it away from us. Or he took it away from them, and he gave it to us. So the reason why we're here is because God gave it to us. He owns it. You know, if you own a piece of real estate, and you let someone live there for a time being, so they can pay rent and take it for a certain time. But if you then want to repossess it, you want to give it to someone else, you have a right to do that. So if they break the contract, the Torah later says that the nations of the world, the seven nations, they engage in all types of idolatry and inappropriate behavior and didn't deserve to be in the land anymore. So they broke the contract, and now, again, God owns the land. He makes the deal, the contract, and they broke the contract. Now he can give it to us, the Jewish people. So that's why, according to Rashi, that's why the Torah begins with Bereishis, with the story of the creation of the world. Now, of course, you know, this Rashi just begs the question, like, what do you do with this Rashi? You know, can you imagine Bibi Netanyahu, when he gives his annual address to the UN, you know, that he would get up and, and he'd make a clap on the podium and say, Rashi, right? The end of discussion. Rashi says, right, that God created the world and can give the land to everyone. So that's why we're annexing the West Bank, because Rashi has told us, Rashi has reminded us the fact that God is the creator and God has given the land to us. I always assume that one of the messages and points that Rashi was making is Rashi, lived in the Middle Ages. He lived right at the time of the, and lived, in fact, during the First Crusade. He was in France, and thank God he was personally spared in 1096. But unfortunately, many of his friends and his teachers were not, who were just over the border, over the Rhine River in Germany, and were massacred during the First Crusades. You know, if you're a Jew living in France and Germany in that time period, you know, the Jews are not even part of the conversation about Israel. Israel is being fought between the Christians and the Muslims. You know, the Jews are in exile, and there's no havamin. There's no even thought at that time period in history that the Jews have any stake, any connection to Israel. It's so remote. And therefore, this is what great chizek, Rashi is such encouragement that Rashi is giving to his fellow Jews that, okay, we're not there right now. We're not part of the conversation right now. But ultimately, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the creator of the earth. And God decides, when it's our time to once again attain and retain the land and go back to it. And even if it seems so remote, it seems to be that the Muslims control Israel, the Christians control Israel, the seven nations. Not to worry. When it's our turn, Hashem's the creator, and Hashem will give it back to us. But nonetheless, as a Jew, as a child, was first learning Chumash, you read this Rashi, you're reminded right from the outset that the land of Israel, God is the creator of the world, and God ultimately gives the land to us, to the Jewish people. And that promise of God giving the land to the Jewish people was given to our avos, was given to Avram, and then to his son Yitzchak, and then to his son Yaakov. Hashem Amar Avram, Hashem says to Avram after he separated from Lot, God tells Avram, look in all directions where you're standing, north and south and east and west. He has called Asher HaTarah, this entire land that you are seeing, this entire land, not just Tel Aviv, not just Haifa, but this entire land, Hebron, Yerushalayim, everywhere that you see, L'cha nena, I'm giving it to you, nine to you, L'zarcha ad olam, to your children forever. This entire land has been given to you. God repeats that promise to Yitzchak. He tells Yitzchak, Gor bar tzazos v'yayimcha v'avrachaka, ki l'cha zarcha, because to you and to your children, etenes kol etzos ha'el. I'm giving you this entire land. And then to Yaakov as well, the same promise is given. When Yaakov's name is changed to Yisrael, he as well is told the promise that this land is going to be given to him and to his descendants. And when you study the book of Bereishis, and really when you study Tanakh, we're talking about the West Bank, annexing the West Bank, and the West Bank referred today as the West Bank, and that's biblical Israel. Right? Tel Aviv is not biblical. Tel Aviv is I'll show you a little bit later, that Tel Aviv certainly is part of the land that was given to the Jewish people. But in terms of where Avos and Himos, where they lived, where they walked, where they taught, where they raised their families, where they created a nation, and then where the Jewish people during the kingdoms of David and Shlomo, and even when the kingdom split, the northern kingdom, the southern kingdom, that's all the West Bank. Right, that's all the cities of Shechem, Hebron, Beitel, Beit Lechem, Yerushalayim, Shiloh. Those are all in what we call today the West Bank or Judea and Samaria. In fact, the first city that Avram comes to when he enters Israel, as he's coming from Mesopotamia, he enters from the north, heading towards the south. He enters Shechem. Shechem is the first city that he arrives at. We know Shechem later on, with several stories in the Torah, including with Yosef when he goes to see his brothers. That's in Shechem. Yosef is buried in Shechem. The whole story with Dina is in Shechem. Hebron, Maris HaMachpelah, Beitel, Beit Lechem, Yerushalayim, Shiloh, where the Mishkan is situated. These are all in the West Bank. That is Israel. That's where the Jewish people, that's where we create this incredible, wonderful kingdom. And therefore, for Jewish people, again, Jews who are so connected to the Tanakh, to our Holy Bible, we have such an attachment to this part of Israel. Right? You might love going to Netanya, going to the beach. It's wonderful. It's fun. It's enjoyable. But when you think about our history and our forefathers, and this is where they lived and breathed. This is where they taught. This is where they created such an incredible kingdom, where the Torah was disseminated to the world. This is in the area of the West Bank. Now, jumping forward many, 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 many years down the road. So what happened? So we know this. I'm not going to repeat. We know the story. We're going to have the 3 weeks coming up and starting in another week. The Jews ultimately are exiled. They're sent away from the land of Israel. There always are Jews that throughout the last 2,000 years without the exile living in Israel. They're small in numbers, in different pockets. We know when the Ramban, Nachmanides, makes his way from Spain to Israel, he finds two Jewish brothers the only two Jews living in Yerushalayim at the time. And yet he tells us that from time to time, Jews come to Yerushalayim to make a minyan. I think on Shabbos, on Yom Tovim. We know from the Baliyat Tosfos, a certain stage number of them made Aliyah. You know, in the 1500s, many Jews come. There always are Jews living in Israel, but already from the 600s, from the advent of Islam, so Israel is controlled predominantly by Muslims. Right? There's a 100 year or so a period where it's called the Latin Kingdom of Jerusalem, where the Crusades were partially successful at a certain point from wrestling the land of Israel from the Muslims. But that quickly fell apart as well. And predominantly the Muslims have control over Israel under different reigns. And since, I believe, I think the 1500s, 1600s, the Ottoman Empire, they were the ones controlling Israel, and a good chunk of the Middle East, and as well as parts into Europe and Africa as well, at different stages, depending upon the strength of the Ottoman Empire. And when it comes to the late 1800s, early 1900s, the beginning of the Zionist movement, where you have a lot of conversations and different books are being written, disseminated, conferences are being called, Jews are coming together and dreaming of creating a state in our ancient homeland, there's one major, major problem. Right? If you're Herzl, you have this incredible dream, there's one huge problem. The problem is that someone else controls the land of Israel. Right? In the late 1800s, early 1900s, it's the Ottoman Empire. Right? You can't just walk in and say, this is mine, this is someone else's. Right? Imagine someone walking into the city of Southville, walking to Michigan, saying, it's mine. Well, yeah, it's yours. It's Michigan's. It's the United States of America. You can't just walk in and say that it's yours. So you know, the early Zionists, they have this idea that they're going to start buying territory, buying land. And they start, you know, these people who own land and we're going to refer to as Palestine at the time. It's all little pieces here and there, and different Jews are helpful in giving various funds to be able to purchase land. Little pockets here and there are being bought, but to create a state in that land, that's not going to happen because again, it's owned by it's controlled by the Ottoman Empire. But everything changes in World War One. Right, in World War I, the Ottoman Empire, joins Hungary and Austria and Germany, and of course they are defeated, and everything now opens up, right? Everything that there's now an opportunity for the Jewish people, perhaps, maybe, to now actually create a state. If it's no longer going to be under Ottoman control, maybe we can petition the Allied forces, the nations of the world, to now give it to us. And therefore, Jewish nationalism really picks up. And in 1917, the famous Balfour Declaration, where Chaim Weizmann and many other significant individuals, they do a lot of work with the British, and the British ultimately create this Lord Balfour, the Declaration, where in the famous paragraph here in the middle, His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people. So in Palestine, a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object. It being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. So some very important points in this very small paragraph. Number one, we're going to try to help you out to create a national home in Palestine. It doesn't say anything about borders or what exactly it means. In Palestine, how much of Palestine, what exactly is a national home? But we're going to help you out. But it also says that we recognize that there are other people living there right now. I'm going to show you in a second how many of those other people there are. But it's not like it's a desolate, empty land, right? Maybe the Ottomans, this is happening in 1917. It's still during World War One, right? The Ottomans have not yet been defeated yet, and it's with the assumption, with the hope, that if we defeat the Ottomans, and we will then gain this territory, that we'll be able to help the Jews out to create this national home. But so problem number one, we got to win the war. And even when we win the war, the problem is that there's other people living there right now. And so it's understood that we're not going to prejudice the civil or religious rights right, doesn't anything about political rights, which is very, very important. It says the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine. And then as an aside, it says also it's not going to prejudice the political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. In other words, as many Jews who are supportive of the Zionist cause, there are many others who are against it. And I'm not talking about religious Jews who are against it. I'm talking about ardently secular Jews or Jews who are Reform Jews who felt that it was wrong that we were way past creating separate homelands, that Jews are now a part of a larger society, and then the feeling was this would create anti-Semitism. If the Jews would create their own homeland, maybe other countries would kick the Jews out, say, hey, what are you doing here in Germany? You have your own home in your ancient homeland. Go there. So, you know, there was pushback from Jews against this. So they had in this declaration, they had to be sensitive to that as well. But this Balfour Declaration is the first time, and again, this is 1917. England, Great Britain is the world superpower at the time. It's a very important, significant statement. We'll see how significant it is in a moment. And it says that we're going to help the Jewish people to create a national home in Israel. But... again, the problem is that there's people already living there. So I want to do right now, I want to share with you, it's hard to quote this book. I'm going to quote because the author, unfortunately, over the last number of years, was accused of some pretty not so wonderful things. But he wrote an incredible book about Israel and some of the challenges of Israel. And the beginning of this book called My Promised Land, the author is Ari Shavitz. He very powerfully talks about his great-grandfather, actually was a person from Great Britain who was a part of the Zionist movement and who in the late 1800s, in 1897, went to Israel as part of a mission to survey the land, to begin, the process of thinking about creating a state. And he sort of reimagines his great-grandfather's trip to Israel. And he says the following. He says he's in Ramla at the time, and the great-grandson says the following. He does not see the land as it is. Riding in the elegant carriage from Jaffa to Mikveh Yisrael, he did not see the Palestinian village of Abu Kabir. Traveling from Mikveh Israel to Rishon LeZion, he did not see the Palestinian village of Yazur. On his way from Rishon LeZion to Ramla, he did not see the Palestinian village of Sarfanz. And in Ramla, he does not really see that Ramla is a Palestinian town. Now standing atop the White Tower, he does not see the nearby Palestinian town of Lieda. He does not see the Palestinian village of Haditha, the Palestinian village of Gimzul, or the Palestinian village of El Kubab. My great-grandfather does not see the Palestinian village of Abu Shusha. How can this be, I ask myself, in another millennium? How is it possible that my great-grandfather does not see? You want to create a state, the problem is those people are already here. How are you going to create a state in such an area that's populated already? And he says there are more than 500,000 Arabs, Bedouins, and Jews in Palestine in 1897. There are 20 cities and towns and hundreds of villages. So how can Ben Wich, his grandfather, not notice them? So I'm going to skip to the end where he says, as I observed the blindness of Herbert Ben Wich, his great-grandfather, as he surveys the land from top of the tower, he says, now I understand him perfectly. My great-grandfather does not see because he is motivated by the need not to see. He does not see because if he does see, he will have to turn back. But my great-grandfather cannot turn back. So that he can carry on, my great-grandfather chooses not to see. In other words, for the Zionists creating this Jewish state, there is no alternative. Right, they're escaping anti-Semitism in Europe. They see that the Jews will never get ahead in Europe. That as much as the Enlightenment, they thought things would change, things are not changing. And the only alternative is to create our own state. There's a problem. In our ancient homeland, there's people already living there. We'll make it work. We'll figure it out some one way or the other. But the alternative is to die in Europe, which is what happens, right, to those who remain in Europe. They don't anticipate a Holocaust happening. And so, sometimes there's problems before you, and you just have to, okay, maybe in theory doesn't make sense. It's not rational, but we'll figure it out. Because if I don't figure it out, then the alternative is too difficult to comprehend. So here's the challenge of this Balfour Declaration, right? Britain is giving the Jews the opportunity to create this state, but we understand there's non-Jewish communities living there already. And how do we deal with that? So what happens, fast forward, so the Allies win World War I, and post-World War I, as World War I is coming towards an end, the U.S. President Woodrow Wilson, who's also been on the news a lot recently because some of his attitudes, apparently racist attitudes and questions about his name and some universities and statues, but not our topic for right now. But Woodrow Wilson gives a speech to Congress in 1918, and he introduces this idea of self-determination, which is a big buzzword. It's important to know this because Adi Yom HaZeh until this day, the Palestinians living in Israel use this all the time to say how they were robbed of Israel, and we'll explain as we go forward, and how the Jews took something which is not their right to take, and that the Arabs really had first dibs on the land. What is self-determination? So said President Wilson, peoples are not to be handed about from one sovereignty to another by an international conference or an understanding between rivals and antagonists. You can't play Risk with people's lives, right? The game of Risk, right? You play, as a kid growing up, Shabbos afternoon, you play against with your friends, your siblings, and so you're fighting wars, and you're winning different territories. And so it's not right that the United States, the Great Britain, or France, okay, we defeat the Ottoman Turks, and then we'll decide who gets to live there, who doesn't get to live there. What do you mean you get to decide? There's people living there already. Those living there, that's self-determination. National aspirations must be respected. Peoples may now be dominated and governed only by their own consent. Self-determination is not a mere phrase. In other words, if I live somewhere, this in some ways is a Jeffersonian, right, about the Declaration of Independence, right? No taxation without representation. If we live here, you can't impose things upon us that we don't consent, that we feel are harmful, they're not in our best interest, right? We're going to be governed by our own consent, right? The people who are there, they get to determine. So self-determination, if understood and accepted, should have been an end to the Zionist dream. Because what is the population in Palestine at the end of World War I? Right, who should determine what the future of Palestine should be? So according to self-determination, it's the majority of people living there. They get to decide. So if you look at this chart, going back to 1800, so the vast, vast, vast majority of people living in Israel at the time, again, there always are Jews living there, there's 7,000, but there's 246,000 Arabs, and there's Christians as well. By the time you get to 1922, this is couple of years after World War One. So now there's already nearly 84,000 Jews, so it's a huge gain. But look at how many Arabs there are. All right, nearly 600,000 Arabs are there. So what's fair? Right? What's fair is that the majority should decide what the future of the country should be. What to make of it, right? That's self-determination. And by the way, look at 1947. Right, when Israel is UN officially sanctions the creation of a Jewish state, again, even then, right, there's now over 630,000 Jews, which is a fascinating number because we know in the Torah that number 600,000 is very significant, the amount of Jews who leave Egypt, the amount of Jews, at least men, over 20 who enter Israel, and that's the amount of Jews in Israel in 1947. So that's very nice for us. It's very beautiful, meaningful, but there's well over a million Arabs living there. They're the majority. And so self-determination should be the end of the conversation. The Jews should never have received a state. And by the way, self-determination was used in the Paris Peace Conference of 1919, following World War One, to figure out what to do with the various lands defeated by the Allies, not only in the Middle East, but in Europe as well. And I think it's also important to emphasize, and often Jews don't appreciate this or realize this or respect this, Jews will often, many ardent Zionists will often say, well, there never was an official Palestinian people. There never was an official Palestinian nation or country. And that's true. But that doesn't mean there weren't aspirations amongst the Arabs at the same time during World War One, also for there to be Arab nationalism, for there to be one unified Arab state within the Middle East, including what today what we call the State of Israel. And so there's these famous or infamous, depending on how you look at it, MacMahon-Hussein correspondence in 1916. The British were trying to woo the Arabs to support them in their fight against the Ottomans. And the British had their high commissioner in Egypt, Sir Henry MacMahon, speak to the person who really represented the Arab community at the time in Mecca, the Sharif of Mecca, Hussein bin Ali. And the Arabs, they said, okay, you want us to support you, fine, but we want a commitment for you for territory. And they were very clear in the territory that they wanted, right? And they told the borders. The West was the Red Sea and the Mediterranean Sea back to Mersin in Turkey, which includes, which is Israel. It's modern-day Israel, modern-day Lebanon. That's what they, that, now, there was these back-and-forth letters, and it's a little bit unclear if the British committed anything or not, and this wasn't any official, treaty or anything. But, you know, the Arabs were also working at the same time to sort of create some state as well. It's important just to be aware of that. Now, as this is all going on, as again, the British are trying to woo the Arabs to help them out. And at the same time, the British are making commitments to the Jews to create a national homeland in Palestine. Well, also in back in the United States, Woodrow Wilson has this inquiry commission. And they're all, again, everyone's trying to figure out, you know, what to do, you know, once the war is over. So this 1917 U.S. Inquiry Commission says the following. It is right that Palestine should become a Jewish state if the Jews, being given full opportunity, make it such. So there was this recognition that the Jews have a connection to their ancient homeland. It was the cradle and home of their vital race, which has made large spiritual contributions to mankind, and it is the only land in which they can hope to find home of their own. There's not Uganda and not somewhere in Montana, right? Ancient Israel, all right? The land of Israel, Eretz Israel. They begin in this last respect, unique among significant people. So the United States as well, again, it's not always known, the United States was also supportive of the Jews creating a state. Now, the problem is that it seems to be a machlokas, a disagreement within Wilson himself, a steer of Mineo Bay, an inherent contradiction. How can you at the one time advocate self-determination that the majority rules, people living there get to decide, but then say the Jews have a right to Israel? They're not living there. They're the minority, right? It's something that's going to collide. It's two ideas that can't be reconciled. And so what ultimately happens, however, is that ultimately under Wilson's direction, there's a League of Nations is formed. And in Article 22 of the Common League of Nations, now in January 2020, this is after the 1919 Paris Peace Conference, when nothing yet at that point was officially decided about the Middle East, this is when the League of Nations decided that we have to make a final determination of who's going to get what in the Middle East, and we're going to create a mandatory system, right, mandates, where we're going to help out the people who are ultimately going to create a state. They're not ready yet to create a state. So we, the victors, right, the British, the French, we're going to help them out. We're going to support them in creating a state. So that's Article 22 of the Common League of Nations. Right, if you're thinking British mandate, this is where the British mandate is going to begin. And then something very significant happens. And for some reason, it's not as famous and as well known. But this is, again, as I told you, in Paris in 1919, nothing was yet determined. And so these world powers come back together, the United States, Great Britain, France, Italy, and Japan, and they gather in San Remo in Italy in April 2020 to now address the Middle East. And this is very important to read this, because this is official. This is legal. This is international law now that's being created. So they say the high contracting parties agreed to entrust by application of the provisions of Article 22, the administration of Palestine within such boundaries as may be determined by the principal allied powers to a mandatory to be selected by the said powers. In other words, we're gonna create these states, these areas, We're going to give it to the people that we're about to determine. And the mandatory, you know, the various, like the British, the French, they're going to help things out. They're going to help partner with these other peoples to make these countries come to fruition. All right, the mandatory will be responsible for putting into effect a declaration. Here we go. Originally made on November 8th, 1917 by the British government and adopted by other allied powers. And listen to the language now. In favor of the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people. It being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. If that sounds familiar to you, it should be, because we just said it a few moments ago, that's the Balfour Declaration. The Balfour Declaration was just a declaration. It was a commitment by the British to try to help the Jews out. But now the Balfour Declaration became incorporated into international law. This is why the Balfour Declaration is so significant. Because in San Remo, the Allies decided, again, this is going to, we'll see in a moment, this is going to be sanctioned now by the League of Nations, that that the Jews are being given their ancient homeland to create a state there. Again, the Balfour Declaration is, they use word for word, they take the declaration to now say this is now international law. So the Jews are being given Israel to create a Palestine, to create a state. And in 1922, the mandate for, it's called the Mandate for Palestine. Again, this is 2 years later after the San Remo Conference. It now officially becomes international law. The mandatory shall be responsible for seeing that no Palestine territory shall be ceded or leased to or in any way placed under the control of the government of any foreign power. In other words, it's been given to the Jews and no one else. Very important. It's been given to the Jews and no one else. That's the responsibility of the mandatory. The mandatory is going to be Great Britain. Your job is to make sure that the Jews get a state in that area and no one else. And Article 25 of that mandate says the following, a special provision giving Britain the right to allocate the territory lying between the Jordan River and the eastern boundary of Palestine to something other than a Jewish national home. This is very important language. The original British mandate, the San Remo Conference, 1920, what was given to the Jews? So this is also not well known. You know what was given to the Jews? All of what we say today is modern Israel, which includes the Gaza Strip, which includes the West Bank, and includes what we say today, the modern country of Jordan. That was all given to the Jews but in 1920. Then in 1922, when they officially made it under law, the Mandate of Palestine, the League of Nations, they then made this provision that that Britain does have the right, anything east of the Jordan River, they can give to someone else. That part east of the Jordan River does not have to be part of a national Jewish home. And we know that ultimately comes Jordan. But what's significant about this is not what's given to the Jordan, but what it says about what's west of the Jordan River. What does it say about what's west of the Jordan River? Right, the West Bank. Who's that being given to? Again, this is international law. It was given to the Jews. Okay, this is not just like a commitment, a little lollipop were given to the Jews. This is law, legal, that the Jews were given everything west of the Jordan River, which includes, of course, the West Bank. Now, this San Remo resolution was so significant to listen to some of the reactions of people who responded to it. So Lord Curzon, who was the British Foreign Affairs Secretary for Great Britain, who was part of the San Remo Conference, he called it the Magna Carta of the Zionists. And then Chaim Weizmann, who was the president, of course, of the Zionist organization, the one who was very involved, of course, in the Balfour Declaration, look what he says, something so powerful. He said, the San Remo decision has come. The recognition of our rights in Palestine is embodied in the treaty with Turkey and has become part of international law. This is the most monumentous political event in the whole history of our movement. And it is, get a load of this, perhaps, no exaggeration to say in the whole history of our people in the exile. And I think he's absolutely correct. Because this, at this point, the world community finally said and made it law that Israel, ancient Israel, was being given to the Jews to create their states. And that's it. That was determined, right? League of Nations, international law. It was being given, the Jews can once again create a state in their ancient homeland. And what territory are we talking about? It's very clear from this from the San Remo resolution, it's everything from the west, from the Jordan River to the west, which includes all of Israel, including the West Bank, including Gaza. David Lloyd George, who was the prime minister at that time of the United Kingdom, if you've been to Israel, if you've gone to Baca, there's a Rehov Lloyd George, which is right off of Emek Rephaim. I think it's between Emek Rephaim and Rehov Derech Beit Lechem. It's just a few minute walk to the old train station, right to the Rakevet, right there. Lloyd George. There's a good reason why they gave the industry after Lloyd George, and he made a very powerful statement. He said, he understood that the Arabs were upset, the fact that the British gave Palestine to the Jews, but he said, hey, look what we gave you, Arabs. Right before 1917, who controlled the Middle East predominantly? It was the Ottomans. There was no country of Lebanon and of Syria and of Iraq. We gave that all to you, said Lloyd George, right? We've won independence in Iraq, Arabia, Syria, Transjordania, right? We've given all those things to you. You know, be happy. I hope he says that, remembering all that, they will not grudge at a small notch. They should be upset at a small little piece of what are now Arab territories been given to the Jewish people, who for all these 100 years have been separated from it. You know, he's telling the Arabs, calm down. The vast majority of the Middle East is yours. A little tiny little piece of land, a little strip, right? A little corner has been given to the Jews. But everything else has been given to you. So we haven't harmed you, Arabs. We've done incredible things for you. So that was Lloyd George. And then that was Balfour said that. And there's the Lloyd George quote. Again, these two different quotes. They both say the similar thing, that we've given all this territory to the Arabs, and just a little piece we gave to the Jews. Everything became finalized in July 24th, 1923. I don't know exactly pronounce this correctly. The Treaty of Lausanne. This is when Turkey signed a formal treaty giving up all claims to the remainder of the Ottoman Empire. You know, this is also misunderstood. Just because you win some territory in war doesn't mean you can keep it, right? It doesn't work that way. You know, just if I push you out of your house because I'm stronger than you, I don't get to keep it, right? So, you know, that's often a misunderstanding. You know, people say, oh, the Jews, you know, won the West Bank in the Six-Day War. It's theirs. That's not why it's theirs. It's because you win something in war doesn't mean you get to keep it. Eventually, you got to give it back, right? It's just, you know, you temporarily allow to defend yourself, protect yourself. You can't just conquer another country. So what allowed, again, international law, San Remo Conference, the San Remo Resolution gave this land, this conquered land, former Ottoman territory to the Jews, but Turkey had to officially renounce it, that they no longer have claim to the Middle East. And by the way, it's not only for Israel it's important to recognize this. The legitimacy of Syria, of modern-day Iraq, modern-day Lebanon, they also, their legitimacy is based upon the same treaty that the Ottomans officially renounced their claims to their former territory. Had they not, then there would be no legal basis for the modern, you know, creation country of Iraq or of Syria as well. Important to understand that. But they did this. 1923, and therefore no longer their territory. The international countries, League of Nations, have given the land to the Jewish people. Okay, Shalom Yisrael, everything should now be wonderful. The Jews, with the help of the British mandate, should now create a state, and everyone should live happily ever after. But we don't live happily ever after. Why not? Because between 1923 and 1947, it goes back to what I read to you before about all those villages and cities of those Arabs living in Palestine. You know, it's these people living in Palestine, what do they care that the Arabs got Iraq, that they got Syria, that they got Jordan? You know, imagine like today, someone would come in and would say, you know, all Jews have to leave Michigan. But don't be upset because you have New York, you have Florida, you have California. You got all that, just you can't live in Michigan. So what would you feel? So the Jews in New York and Florida would say, okay, come live with us. But Michigan, this is our home. We raise our children. There's our homes, our businesses, right? We like the air here. We like the weather. We like the environment. We're comfortable here, right? So what does it matter that an Arab in Iraq has this great country now? If I'm an Arab living in Palestine, I've been living there, my family's been there for the last 300, 400, 500 years, or even the last 100 years, and I've been grazing my cattle and my sheep, you know, in this one location. I don't care that there's a Syria that exists. I want to stay here. So that's very important to be sensitive to that. Furthermore, what's also very, very important to realize, it's also from just a perspective of Islam, it's the pride is a very important value for Arabs, and to be told that, you know, that some foreign country powers, you know they never heard of, British, French, the United States, they're telling them they can't live somewhere, or that they don't have a right to control their own destiny, that some other people, the Jews, that they're now going to be in control of things, they want no part of that, right? They're totally disinterested in that. And so what happened between 1923 and 1947 is a very challenging time for Jews living in Israel. On the one hand, they're beginning to create a state. They're building infrastructure. They're creating culture and business and all different. They're draining the swamps and kibbutzim and all these wonderful things. But there's a lot of Arab, resentment and there's pockets of some terrible violence direct against the Jews. The British are sort of caught in the middle. And the British begin to backtrack on their promises, and the British begin to give in to a lot of the Arab violence. And again, the British are both, you feel bad for them. And they're also at fault. They're at fault because they made all these different promises during World War I, contradictory promises. And at the same time, like, they're sort of caught in the middle because, you know, they're there controlling things, but the Arabs aren't interested in what's going on, and it's a mess. And so slowly but surely, a lot of the original commitments that people like Balfour and Lloyd George made, other British officials begin to vastly change the conversation. Immigration is severely limited. They begin to come up with plans to severely limit the amount of land that the Jews can receive for their state. Now, again, this is all against international law, because international law, the San Remo Conference, says that the Jews get everything. And yet the British begin to play games. And ultimately what happens, again, 1947, the British say, we're out of here, we can't handle anymore. The UN has to decide what it's going to be. And the UN makes their famous partition plan. This is the famous vote. And we know a Jew is listening to the radios. I want to hear if the UN is really going to create a state, which they do. And they vote in favor of a state. The problem is that the state is much, much smaller than what was originally committed and promised to them at the San Remo Conference. And they only get 57% of the land, and even of the land that they get, they're just a slight majority in that land. Right? There's almost 500,000 Jews there, but there's over 400,000 Arabs that are going to be part of this Jewish state. And then the parts that we know today, the West Bank, the Gaza, and other parts, the northern part of Israel, the Galilee, are going to be given to the Arabs for a separate state. There's 725 Arabs living in that area and only 10,000 Jews. So there's very few Jews living in the West Bank in 1947. In addition, Yerushalayim, which was and continues to be an extremely hot-button issue, they decide it's going to be an international zone, but they make it in favor of the Arabs. It's also not well known. They include this in this international zone, not only Jerusalem, but also Beit Lechem, Bethlehem. Why? Because the majority of people at the time living in Yerushalayim were Jews, or 100,000 Jews, 60,000 Arabs. And they had decided that within 10 years, the local inhabitants would decide its future. So clearly the Jews would be in control. They would decide its future. So in order to make sure that the Jews wouldn't make the final decision, they included Bethlehem, which was a vast majority, of course, were Arabs. And now he made it much more even, with the assumption that the Arabs, with population growth, would surpass the Jews within those 10 years, and then ultimately it would become an Arab enclave. Again, that's not well known, that fact. So what happens, the partition plan? So the Jews accept it, right? It's incredible that they accept it. Not only like, what are they, crazy? They lost all this territory. So the theory why they accept it is because they needed something. right? Like they saw how precarious and bad the situation was, and the thing was getting resolved. And at least finally, it's not the ideal, but at least we can at least have a state. Also, the other major issue they had to deal with was the post-Holocaust. You had these hundreds of thousands of survivors, many of them trying to get to Israel, many of them being stopped by the British, being placed in different camps, in Cyprus and in near Haifa. And like, they had to resolve that, so they had no choice. They accept the partition plan. The Arabs, of course, famously reject the partition plan, and this is very important to understand the current situation. Because the Arabs never accepted the partition plan never became international law, because the UN resolution was not a Security Council resolution. It was a General Assembly resolution, and the General Assembly resolutions are not binding unless everyone agrees to it. And here, not everyone agreed to it, right? One party, the Arabs, rejected it. So it never became a binding law. And therefore, again, to emphasize, the only binding law in terms of determining the status of Israel is now still the San Remo Conference, which gave everything to the Jews. And so what happens, right? The Arabs reject the partition plan. Immediately they launch this war against the Jews. And in 1949, finally this armistice agreement. Now the armistice agreement, this is the map we're familiar with. The Jews obviously gained a lot of territory during the independence war, right? So this is a lot more than the previous map, right? They gained a lot more, but they don't, the West Bank, they don't get. And the Gaza Strip, they don't get. Who gets those territories? Well, Jordan gets the West Bank. Why does Jordan get the West Bank? Because they fought against the Jews and they just took over that territory. Egypt gets the Gaza Strip because they fought in the war and they took over that territory. Well, that territory was never given to Jordan. It was never given to, in fact, they were occupiers. They were illegal occupiers. The Jordanians in the West Bank and the Egyptians in the Gaza Strip. And in fact, the famous 1949 armistice agreement between the Jews and the Arab countries intentionally, and this is from the UN, said that this agreement to end the conflict should not be construed in any sense as a political or territorial boundary, right? This was not any legal boundaries, this West Bank, the Gaza Strip. This was just like, okay, everyone put your guns down, no more fighting, right? And the Jordanians, you know, gained control of East Jerusalem, including the old city of Yerushalayim, including the Koto, but it was never, you know, this whole thing about the Green Line today and that's international law and that's where, you know, everything has to begin the conversation. I mean, that's a false narrative. There's never anything that ever said that has to be the status of, of who gets what territory. This is just where they put their arms down when the fighting stopped. That was 1949. Then comes the Six-Day War. And the Six-Day War, famously, right, Israel, conquers all this territory, including the Sinai Peninsula, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip, and the UN Resolution 242. So there's a contradiction within UN Resolution 242 that each side can claim victory. On the one hand, it said that Israel had to withdraw. Right? The UN said Israel had to withdraw its armed forces from territories occupied in the recent conflict. It sounds like they got to leave the West Bank. You got to leave the Gaza Strip. On the other hand, it also said termination of all claims of belligerency and respect for acknowledgement of the sovereignty, territorial integrity, and political independence of every state in the area and the right to live in peace within secure and recognized boundaries free from threats or acts of force, which means that, okay, on the one hand, Israel should have to withdraw from territories it conquered. On the other hand, that's only if there can be security and safety, right? In other words, Israel's not being told to leave if by leaving there, they're going to be put in danger. So, you know, each side could say that we're in compliance with UN Resolution 242. You know, the Arabs have said since the Six-Day War, we're only going to begin negotiations if the Jews leave the West Bank. It never says there that has to take place. And that's the requirements. It says Israel should withdraw from that, but it also says at the same time, only if it's secure and safe. And if Israel feels it's not secure and safe, then we got things to discuss. So to bring this point now all together, is Israel an occupier of the West Bank? So Israel's made a strong case, and I've done a lot of research on this, and it's hard to see the Arab perspective on this from a legal perspective. Get to a moral perspective in a second, but from a legal perspective, it's hard to see the Arab claim here, because at the end of the day, the only international binding agreement that determined who has rights to the entire land of Israel is that San Remo conference that was adopted by the League of Nations, and nothing ever changed after that. The partition plan would have changed things, but it was rejected by the Arabs, and it never became international law. And therefore, occupation, if you look at the international community, the Red Cross, they define occupation when a state exercises non-acquiesced effective control over territory on which it has no sovereign title. Does Israel not have sovereign title over the West Bank? The answer is no. In fact, they do have sovereign title. They're the only ones who have sovereign title over the West Bank. According to the International Court of Justice, occupation, in order for belligerent occupation to exist, the occupying army must actually exercise its authority in the territory and thereby supplant the authority of the sovereign government in that area. What was the sovereign government in the West Bank before the Six-Day War? It wasn't Jordan. Again, Jordan was, they were the occupiers. They were the legal occupiers. And the only one you could say maybe was Turkey, the Ottoman Empire. But the Ottoman Empire renounced its ownership in 1923. So you can make a very strong argument that the Jews have every right, legal right, to the West Bank. In addition, occupation is a dirty word, but in international law, it's also permitted sometimes for security needs. And that's when it comes to the Golan Heights. The Golan Heights clearly was given to Syria. It was not given to the Jewish people. But Israel's always claimed that they have every right to occupy and continue to occupy the Golan Heights for under international law for security needs, because they were constantly being attacked right from the high ground, the Golan Heights, into the Galilee when Syria was in control. And and then the question is the word annexation even correct here? We're saying Israel is interested in annexing the West Bank. Well, annexation is only when you're taking a territory that's not yours, right? But this is not, as you just demonstrated, this is not the territory of anyone else. Again, if anything, they're just reclaiming sovereignty to a land that legally is theirs. So I want to wrap things up in the next 5-10 minutes. But I think what I've tried to demonstrate from a purely legal perspective, I've always not understood the international community's, and to this day, argument that Jews are illegal occupiers, that these settlers are, occupying Palestinian land. For at least from a legal international law perspective, I've never seen anyone demonstrate where that's correct. Now, again, the Arabs can say that they're upset with the whole thing to begin with. Who are these foreign powers, the British, the French, to take away land that they've been living on? But again, under international law, they defeated the Ottoman Turks, who were the legal owners of that territory. And through these international agreements, they then received the territory. Then they were able to give it to who they chose. They gave the Arabs tons of land. They gave them all of Iraq, all of Syria, all of Lebanon, all of Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and they gave a little notch, right, as Balfour said, just to the Jews, a small little area. So, again, from a law perspective, it's really hard to see why Israel is in the wrong here. But then there's the question of morality, and I'll just end with this in terms of something to think about. Yossi Klein Halevi, who's an American, made Aliyah, lives in Israel, is a very prolific author. He wrote a great book called Like Dreamers, talking about different soldiers, different perspectives during the Six-Day War, part of the paratrooper battalion that ultimately captured and the Yerushalayim, the old city, and the Kotel, Har Bayit. He recently wrote a very fascinating book called Letters to My Palestinian Neighbor, which tries to have a dialogue with the Palestinians regarding our conflicting narratives. And in that book, he says the following. He said, "We could not remain a democratic state with ethical Jewish values if we became a permanent occupier of your people, Arab people, nor did we want to. I didn't return home to deny another people its own sense of home." Here's the conundrum. Here's the problem. You can argue all you want that legally the Jews have every right to every square inch of the land of Israel. But at the end of the day, there's all these people living there who are not Jewish, who don't want to be under Jewish control. And they've been living, many of them, not all of them, some of them came only when the Jews started coming because of the economic opportunities. But as we saw earlier, many were living there well before the vast majority of Jews were there. You know, and to take over, you know, imagine someone taking over your home in Michigan. It's a little fair. It's not fair, right? This is my home. This is where I grew up. This is my family. You know, where we've lived for generations. And so morally, it doesn't seem just. Again, whatever our issues are in Europe and having to find a homeland, but then just to say that we're taking over this land. And again, we're not only talking about the West Bank. It's important to remember. We're talking about the entire land of Israel, right? I mean, there were Arabs living everywhere. This is very, we don't always appreciate this. Many Jewish neighborhoods, cities, huge cities today are built on areas that once were places where Bedouins grazed their animals. And so, you know, these early Zionists, a lot of their thinking was that okay, you know, they're here, we'll come here, there's lots of room for everyone, you know, we'll all be happy. Or that, you know, we'll make their lives better. This is like, you know, still many Jews in Israel think this way. You know, the Arabs should be happy we're here. We're creating incredible infrastructure. We're building great roads and energy sources, and we're making their lives better. So on the one hand, that's very true. But on the other hand, it doesn't mean that they want it. You know, you're different cultures and different values. And again, it can be very painful to be under the control of someone else. You don't want to be under their control, their domination, you know, or their legal system, their value system. And so from a moral perspective, for, you know, Jews to control an area, and which is still to this day, let's just look at the West Bank. It's predominantly not Jewish. Again, there's maybe 500, 600,000 Israelis who live in the West Bank today, right? All these settlements, the Gush and Ma'ar Adumim and all these Ariel, all these other areas. But the vast majority there's over 2 million Arabs, right, living there today. And so they're the majority in that area. And the Arabs who live there today, they're not Israeli citizens. They can't vote in Israeli elections. And yet they're under Israeli military control. Now, the annexation that Israel is talking about is not the entire West Bank. They're talking about, I think, highest numbers, like a 30%, which includes the major settlement blocks and also includes the Jordan Valley, which Israel claims is very important strategically in terms of protection. If there's going to be a future Palestinian state in the West Bank, that they shouldn't have any borders with any Arab countries, because you'll have what happened with Gaza, with smuggling from Egypt into Gaza. They don't want weapons being smuggled, you know, from Iraq through Jordan into Palestine, you know, into a country of Palestine. So they want control over that Jordan River valley. But nonetheless, again, it's a moral ethical question. How can you control people who don't want to be controlled by you? They can't vote. And I think it's important to remember, not everyone agrees with this. Rabbi Soloveitchik was of the opinion, again, many disagreed with him, but he was of the opinion that in theory, it's all theoretical, but in theory, making a deal, land for peace, is, if it's going to save Jewish lives, you go for it. Right? Mashiach isn't yet here yet, hasn't arrived, and Jewish blood is more value than even the holy land like Hebron. Every time I go to Israel, I go to Hebron. I love going to Hebron. I love going to Maaseh Machpelah. But it's not as important as Jewish blood. Jewish lives is more important, right? And so Hashem will determine in the future what things will be. Well, we don't have to compromise Jewish lives. As we say, we need to hold every square inch of the land of Israel at this point in time. Now, annexation, last two or three slides, is that, what would be the benefits? What would be the concerns first for annexation? So, you know, there's a lot of, you know, Israel really has to think, and this is why I think they didn't make any decision today. You know, there's a lot of, obviously, opposition, of course, amongst the Arabs. International community is a lot of them are very opposed. Now, they also were opposed to, Israel declaring and U.S. supporting, you know, Yerushalayim as the capital of Israel and the U.S. embassy moving there. But, there's a lot of threats of violence if this goes through. And Israel has to consider about, you know, the lives of Israeli civilians and soldiers. If I'm not mistaken, although it was pretty minimal, the violence after Israel officially, U.S. moved its embassy to Yerushalayim. If I'm not mistaken, at least one Jew was killed in some of the violence. One Jew was killed. So, you know, that's always a danger. You know, you make decisions like this, what's going to be the repercussions? What's going to be the response? Are Israeli citizens, who are dealing with coronavirus right now and other things, are they going to have to deal with rockets, you know, raining down on their cities, you know, in the north and in the south? What about IDF resources? You know, Netanyahu always says that Israel's biggest threat is not the Palestinians, it's the Iranians. They have to deal with violence. I mean, it's not going to be able to deal with Iran, gaining a foothold in Syria and Lebanon. And that, what's a bigger concern, a strategic concern? What about all the relations Israel's tried to develop over the years with the Arab states? What about potential economic sanctions that European countries may exert over Israel if they make this move? What if the Palestinian Authority collapses as a result of this, and all of a sudden Israel now has to deal with humanitarian disaster, dealing with all the Arabs living in the West Bank, and, you know, Israel's having a financial problem right now, like every other country, with the coronavirus, where it's also now you have to deal with 2 million people who now are dependent upon you because the Palestinian Authority collapsed. These are all things, very complicated, messy things that Israel has to consider. It makes annexation not necessarily the most, the smartest move to make at this time. At the same time, there are some benefits, perhaps, to Israel for annexation. Security, again, you know, Israel gaining control of the Jordan Valley. It will further strengthen Israel's hand in future negotiations, that this will no longer be on the bargaining table. And it will force the Palestinians perhaps to make more compromises that they're unwilling to make it at this point. Every time the Palestinians push back, they lose, right? They rejected the partition plan. They rejected these white papers that the British made earlier. They lost territory. Six-day war. Every time they're always losing more. So at some point, it's all going to disappear. So maybe this will be a way to force them to finally themselves to make some sort of compromises. Also, there's all these complicated laws right now because the parts of the West Bank is not officially under Israeli control. Even like real estate, when you buy land there, it's all under ancient Ottoman and mandatory Jordanian military zoning laws. It's very messy. So if that'll be under Israeli, not like Israeli real estate law is any easier to deal with, but at least it's only dealing with one body, not with multiple bodies to try to figure things out. And I think maybe the biggest reason why Israel would want to annex is because it sends a strong message that this is ours. We're not leaving. Right? Just like when Israel, the U.S. Embassy moves to Yerushalayim, this is our capital, Olam Vav, forever and ever. So this West Bank, these, Hebron, or not Hebron, but, the Gush and Ariel and Mali Demim, this is ours. Not for open for negotiations. That's a very strong statement. And so I'll just conclude by saying the following. And I'm not going to say yes, no, right, wrong. That's for each one of us to think ourselves, and ultimately for Israel and its citizens to decide. What are the ancient borders of Israel? So the ancient borders of Israel do include the West Bank. Again, that's where our whole history began, with Avram initially coming to Israel, entering through Shechem. Right, that's where the kingdoms of David and Shlomo were. We see on this map the red line is the Torah's outlining the borders of Israel, which clearly includes areas all west of the Jordan River. The blue line is Yechezkel talking about the future borders of Israel, which also, again, there's slight changes, but again incorporates the main part of Israel, which again in part including the West Bank, but ultimately. What ultimately happens with Israel, it ultimately is in our hands. Not necessarily in our political hands, but it's in our spiritual hands. And that's what the Torah tells us very powerfully. The Torah says in Sefer Devarim, Dim yirchav Hashem alkecha eskevulcha kasher nishpal avosecha, right, if God will enlarge your territory, as he swore to your forefathers, and it will give you this entire land, that he promised, right? The entire land, Tel Aviv, Haifa, Be'er Sheva, Hebron, Beit Lechem, Shiloh, Yerushalayim, all of it. How are we going to get all of it? Here's the formula. your guard to do this entire mitzvah, right? This Torah. Asher anochi mitzavcha yom la'avos Hashem lokecha lechas b'chol drachav kol yamin. You want the land of Israel in its entirety to live in peace and tranquility? We keep the Torah, right? To love Hashem, your God, and to follow all His ways. That's the ultimate formula. All right now, it's, you know, we have to do our best and we have to make these very complex, difficult decisions. They're not easy. There's legal basis, but there's very complex moral and ethical considerations, as well as security considerations for Israel to consider. And it takes a lot of wisdom, a lot of strength to really figure out what the correct move is. But our part, at the very least, is we need to play our role in following the Torah and fulfilling the will of Hashem. And God willing, Hashem will look down favorably upon us, grant us that we make the correct decisions in the immediate term, but also in the long term to send the Mashiach, and that for things to unfold the way ultimately we're told in the Torah and the prophets that they will unfold, where there'll be peace and tranquility for all Jews living in Israel, moving forward, hopefully very soon in our days.
Amen. Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you, Rabbi.